KALW.
People's weddings, baby showers, bridal showers, you name it, we got everything here. This store has everything.
Today, we bid goodbye to Berkeley's go-to party supply store.
Are you guys closing? Yes. And where are you guys moving? We're not moving. We are closing the store. Oh, no. What should I do?
What happens to one small business when its owner decides to retire? Then, what would you do if you witnessed harassment? Would you act?
Imagine yourself in that situation. Put yourself in the position of the targeted person, and they'll come to you to go help them.
And we visit the original rainbow flag for Pride.
The colors are faded, there's spots, there's imperfections. This does not look like a mass-produced object. You can tell it's made with love.
A story from our special Oldest San Francisco. I'm Marissa Ortega-Welch, in for Hannah Baba, and this is Cross Currents. What are the essentials that make for a good party? You'll need guests and snacks, of course. But what about decorations? Streamers, balloons, party hats? For East Bay residents, the store Paper Plus has been the go-to shop for party supplies for decades. But now its owner is ready to retire. And like a lot of small businesses, there's no one to take over the operation. KLW's Pat McMahon dropped by to find out how to throw a proper goodbye party.
Okay, let's see what we got here. Hold on, garland. No. So, yeah. I'm looking for, like, I want a banner that says congratulations. I'm looking, but I don't see.
Kendra James is pulling a shopping basket through the maze of aisles at Paper Plus. Today, she's planning a surprise party for her coworker.
Ladies, I'm looking for graduation stuff. Are you guys wiped out? Up in front. Oh, God.
Kendra turns down another aisle, breezing by the wall of greeting cards, past shelves of cookie cutters, and racks of discounted Halloween costumes. She stops her cart in front of a selection of napkins, plates, and tablecloths, dotted with diplomas and graduation caps. Like a lot of people, she says she's come here for every kind of celebration imaginable.
Oh, my kids, they're 26 and 34, all their birthdays, people's weddings, baby showers, bridal showers, you name it, we got everything here. Man, this store has everything.
Most of all, people love the balloons. In the back, there's a counter where customers can pick out balloons in every color of the rainbow. And hanging from the ceiling are balloons in every shape and size. Characters from Star Wars and Paw Patrol, everything from mustaches and music notes to hot dogs and bottles of champagne. Recent years have seen a rise in specialty orders, columns and arches made of hundreds of balloons for bigger celebrations.
Everything has changed with balloons. It's not more like a helium, it's more structures or that, more, it's more like an art.
Ronnie Carrillo is the longest serving employee at Paper Plus. He is also the resident balloon artist. He and his coworker, Gila Sabzavari, have worked together so long, he's lost track.
10 years?
No, Ronnie, are you kidding me? 16 years.
16 years?
Yeah, I've been working here for 16 years.
They're inflating a dozen green and white balloons for a customer's upcoming get-together.
Are you going to put them outside today or tomorrow?
I'm going to keep them inside my house today. Okay. And then tomorrow, I'm going to take them with me.
Yeah, that's a good idea. I'm not going to make them that big because it's really hot today.
Okay.
Just make sure you keep them inside.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, the thing is that this is like my home, basically, I should say.
Gila says she's gotten used to seeing the same customers coming back. Another year older, celebrating the same special days.
They come in first getting balloons for their kids, and then they, in a few years, you see, they come with their grandkids, and it's amazing. And they know us by our names, and we know them by their names, too. It's so touching. I mean, it's so sad that we cannot see those people anymore.
It's sad because late last year, Paper Plus's owner, Michelle Sherman, announced that the business would be closing after nearly 40 years in operation. Gila says customers keep coming up to her with questions about Paper Plus's future.
Are you guys closing? Yes. And when are you guys moving? We're not moving. We are closing the store. Oh, no. What should I do? It's like, I said, oh, what should we do? I mean,
the customer's fondness for the store is linked with memories of past celebrations, which adds to their sadness. Gila's sad about something else, though.
And that's the thing. Is everybody say, what? Where should I get my balloon from? I said, okay, I don't know, but how am I supposed to live my life without income?
For Gila, the focus is on the future. What comes next? For others, this time of transition is an opportunity to look back.
Okay, so believe it or not, this old building used to be a bowling alley.
That's Michelle Sherman, owner of Paper Plus. We're standing outside taking in the iconic building. If you've never been inside Paper Plus, maybe you've seen it driving down San Pablo. You can't miss it. It's this brightly painted building that looks straight out of the 90s.
My husband decided that a nice, bright turquoise color would definitely catch the eye, and it does.
Paper Plus started down the block as the byproduct of a much larger company. Michelle's mother-in-law founded the stationery store Papyrus. Paper Plus began as a place to sell the excess inventory.
And it started in that building at the very end. And bit by bit, we stayed there for, I think it was 15 years or so.
Sometimes, if the party gets too big, you've got to move things to a second location. In the early 2000s, Paper Plus's operation got too big for their original storefront, so they moved here. Over the years, Paper Plus has survived challenges typical to small businesses these days. The rise of online shopping, the pandemic, and it's overcome hurdles more unique to the party industry, like helium shortages. But now, Michelle says Paper Plus is facing another common small business concern. She's ready to retire, and there's no one to take it over.
And I think that's what we're gonna find with most of the businesses that are closing, is that only the ones that have, like, you know, children that are willing to take it over, or, you know, some kind of a cooperative that can be made out of it.
This question of succession is one that many business owners face. We're talking about this one small business, but there are over 1,200 small businesses in the city more than 20 years old. Berkeley's Office of Economic Development says these businesses account for more than half of the city's small business revenue. As these owners retire, Berkeley faces the risk of losing both the revenue and the jobs they provide. Which is why, in 2018, the city began working with businesses to provide alternatives to closure, like employee ownership models. But it can be hard to plan ahead like that. Owners like Michelle are so busy running the business, there's no time to think what's next. Back inside, she says that stress has taken its toll.
Every last bill that I pay, there's a sense of relief. I don't want to see the dumpster come out and have the merchandise go in it.
Here's the secret. The party isn't actually over. When the news came from Michelle that Paper Plus would close, her longest tenured employee, Ronnie, saw it as the perfect opportunity.
So I think that after 22 years here and I see that it's over, I have to do my own now.
He's decided to open his own party business, right next door.
I am excited. I am really excited. Yeah. And if you want, we can go and check the place.
We walk back outside. 30 steps away, in the same storefront where Paper Plus started, Ronnie will be opening Berkeley Balloons and Events. He took over the lease, reached out to his contacts in the event planning industry, and started acquiring product, even buying some of Paper Plus's inventory.
And I wanted to keep it like a secret for people can be excited that when, oh, we are sorry, you guys are going to close. And then when I had everything ready, he says, no worries, I'm going to open next door.
Ronnie says he's hoping to bring some of his coworkers with him.
She's going to come with me. Huh?
Why not? I need to make money, right?
She is like a very, very good friend. Very, very good friend.
Thank you.
These two have made a living out of helping people celebrate. It's what they love to do.
What I want to do is bring happiness, smiling, you know, that kind of stuff. And this is we say party, but it's like we want to keep that joy.
As a small business owner, Ronnie's going to face some of the same challenges Michelle did at Paper Plus. Now, as with any good party, he's going to need people to show up. In Berkeley, I'm Pat McMahon for CrossCurrents.
Pat reported that story as part of this year's Audio Academy, which he recently graduated from. Congratulations, Pat. You can find all of his work at kalw.org/crosscurrents. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Marissa Ortega-Welch, in for Hannah Baba. Last Monday was Eid al-Adha, a main holy holiday in Islam, also known as the Feast of Sacrifice. In observance, a Muslim group gathered in San Francisco's McLaren Park for communal prayer. But they were disrupted when a man walking two dogs yelled Islamophobic threats at the group.
Your religion is full of hate.
Have a good day. We have a permit to be here. We contacted the city to have a permit.
I think that's horrible what they've done.
You can take it up with the city. It's called democracy. Contact us.
This video was shot by a mosque member.
I never really thought I'd come across, you know, something like that, especially in the city of San Francisco. It's just really, really sad.
The police were called and there is an ongoing investigation. But what would you have done if you were there? Or say you're sitting on a train and the guy next to you starts verbally attacking the woman next to him with racial slurs or homophobic or anti-Semitic or Islamophobic slurs. What would you do? Say something? Physically intervene? How? Bystander intervention training teaches people how to react and what to do when they witness some kind of harassment or attack. Back in 2017, KALW's Hannah Baba attended a training at the Muslim Community Center in Pleasanton for some answers.
So attacking side, are you ready?
Yeah. Ready, set, attack!
In a carpeted banquet hall, trainers Zohar Reza and Andrew Schutz give the go-ahead to about 30 mostly white people standing in two lines facing each other. It's called a hassle line. They partner up. One pretends to be a harasser, and the other a target of the harassment. No bystanders here yet. Participants Kate Wiley and Marion Conning are teamed up. Marion's supposed to keep her cool while Kate verbally harasses her. You can tell it's clearly not in Kate's nature to be an aggressor. It's awkward to try to be mean.
And making bad decisions. How could you do that?
Now they switch. It's Marion's turn to attack.
I've known some stupid people, and you know, this is a stupid idea.
Okay, Marion does a better job. Kate is quiet. And scene. I asked Marion, what was that like for you?
She just was looking right past me and not paying any attention.
Yeah. How did that make you feel?
Don't you know I'm a, you know, pay attention, I'm attacking you.
This is the first lesson. Take away power from your harasser by staying calm, which is hard for some people, like participant Martha Krieger.
Because I'm so confrontational. So it's actually a real exercise to look away. Yeah.
And while all this is fake, it reflects a very real and troubling reality. Hate crimes in California have increased just over the last year. The state is now home to 79 hate groups, according to the Southern Poverty Law Center, the highest in the country. And according to the Council on American-Islamic Relations, who's putting on this training today, anti-Muslim attacks nationwide increased by nearly 60% between 2015 and 2016. Trainer Zohar Reza is herself a target. She's visibly Muslim because she wears a headscarf. And she says it's a necessity for everyone to know what to do in these times.
This is something we're trying to push. We're trying to push for sticking up for each other. Even though times may be bad, we want to create a very connected community.
Reza goes back to the trainees for the next exercise.
So we can go ahead and talk about the first scenario.
This one teaches that if you're witnessing a verbal attack, ignore the aggressor and go up to the targeted person and talk to them. The trainees are broken into small groups and given scenarios to act out, like a man harassing a Muslim woman on a train.
Hey, come on. That's un-American. Get that scarf off.
Or a racist car driver harassing someone on the street.
Honk, honk, you don't belong here. You should get out of here. Throwing trash.
Or an impatient anti-immigrant person standing in line in a shop.
Maybe if you'd speak English, it wouldn't take this long. Hello.
The bystanders start talking to the targeted person as instructed, some moving closer, saying things like, "That's a beautiful scarf. Where'd you get it?" Or just a straight up, "Are you okay?"
Is it okay if I stand right in front of you for a minute?
Zohar Riza nods approvingly, but she cautions, "Always ask for permission."
We're not there to be their savior. We're there to be in solidarity with them. She or he might just want to ignore completely, not talk to anybody. But we always want to give them the option to talk to someone. And that's our role. Going to them, being like, "Can I stay here?" Even if they're like, "Oh, I don't want to talk to you." Be like, "Okay, I'm just going to monitor the situation. I'm going to stay here. If you want to talk to me, I'm right here."
And she makes one thing clear: safety first, always.
If the situation is dangerous, get out of there.
And that's one big reason many witnesses to hate crimes may choose not to act. They're afraid they'll be hurt. Just earlier this year, two men were stabbed when they intervened to help a Muslim woman on a train in Oregon. There's also what psychologists call the bystander effect, that people think, "Oh, someone else will do it." And sometimes it's more complicated, according to Jane Stapleton, a researcher at the University of New Hampshire.
And then there's a lot of, you know, like cultural and environmental factors.
Stapleton's part of the team that created one of the country's most used bystander training programs called Bringing in the Bystander. She explains how complex these situations can sometimes be.
For example, if, you know, you're an African-American male and you see something happening and you're in a predominantly white area, or you're in an area where maybe, members of your family or your social group or your community have had negative interactions with law enforcement, are you likely to pick up, you know, are you likely to take out your cell phone and call 911 and say, you know? So your own experiences can, you know, really influence whether or not you intervene. And we always say that there are reasons why people don't intervene.
So she says bystander training can help people be more conscious if they end up being witnesses to harassment or other crimes. But some critics say this kind of training puts more burden on the bystander than the perpetrator, resulting in a kind of bystander blaming if things go wrong, one step away from victim blaming. Jane Stapleton.
Well, I just disagree with that. I mean, I really think that bystander intervention is about engaging the entire community, and that doesn't take perpetrators off the hook.
Critics also say putting the responsibility on the bystander takes the conversation away from big picture institutional discussions about safety, police, and the justice system, and what role they've played or failed to play in regards to hate crimes. Stapleton acknowledges the need to address all that and adds,
I think bystander intervention is very much a social justice framework as well. I don't see that bystander intervention is an abdication of these larger systemic issues at all.
KLW's Hanna Baba reported that story in 2017. And if you would like to set up a bystander intervention training course for your community, we'll have a link at kalw.org/crosscurrents.
Thank you.
This is Cross Currents. I'm Marissa Ortega Welch, in for Hannah Baba. It's the start of Pride Week, so today we are bringing back our story on the original rainbow flag in San Francisco. Here's KALW's Hannah Baba once more.
Images of the rainbow flag are ubiquitous here. They're hanging in store windows, they stud the escalators in Harvey Milk Plaza, and even make up the stripes in the crosswalk.
We're visiting from Australia right now, and as soon as we got off the train at this stop, the first thing we saw before the naked people was the flags, and we kind of just went, yeah, cool, like we're in a good spot, this is the right place.
But as we'll learn, the rainbow flag has only been a symbol for the queer community for 45 years. In the 60s and 70s, LGBTQ people from around the country flocked to San Francisco. It was just more queer-friendly than other places. Cleve Jones is a human rights activist.
There was a conversation ongoing about the need for a unifying symbol for this emerging community and movement.
Some people were using the pink triangle as a pride symbol, but that was used by the Nazis as a badge of shame for gay people.
We needed something positive and unifying.
Gay rights activists and supervisor Harvey Milk urged artists to design a symbol for the 1978 Freedom Day Parade, now called the Pride Parade. The Parade Decorations Committee made two enormous flags to fly at UM Plaza during the parade, 30 by 60 feet each, so big they couldn't be carried by hand.
Oh, it was just gorgeous. You know, when the wind took it and the sun broke through the morning clouds, it was just extraordinarily beautiful. I'd never seen a flag that large, and the colors were just so vibrant, so it really did take my breath away. But the most lovely part of that morning, though, was just standing on the sidelines and watching as all the people in the parade came walking through between the two flags. We just watched as thousands of people walked beneath them and looked up, and their faces were just transformed. There was such a joyousness to it that I'll never forget.
One of those original flags is on display at the GLBT Historical Society Museum on 18th Street at Castro. Andrew Schaffer works at the museum. He says receiving the original rainbow flag was almost a religious experience.
When we were installing it, I got to very delicately wearing gloves, just touch a little piece of the fabric, and it sort of felt like touching like the Shroud of Turin. Like this is kind of our queer origin stories. It felt like touching something that is almost magical.
But the flag is very real. It lives in a glass display case in all of its eight glorious original colors. The size is impressive, even though only about a third of the original flag remains.
Yeah, as we're walking up to the flag, you can see obviously the colors first, but as you get closer, you can see they're kind of discolored.
It's made of cotton muslin. 45 years later, it has an almost fuzzy quality.
No one makes a flag out of this kind of fabric.
The people who made it hand-dyed each stripe. It kind of looks like tie-dye.
The colors are faded, there's spots, there's imperfections. This does not look like a mass-produced object. You can tell it's made with love.
On that original flag design, there were eight stripes, and each color had a meaning.
So pink for sex, red for life, orange was for healing, yellow for the sun, green for nature, turquoise was for art and magic, blue for serenity, and purple for the spirit.
Andrew says the rainbow flag just captured the zeitgeist of the moment. 2 years earlier, in 1976, people rallied around the American flag during the bicentennial of the United States.
The rainbow flag did a similar thing for queer people, where it was something that we could grab onto and say, like, this is going to bring us all together. So that was the intention. And I think it sort of maps to that moment in queer history where, again, things looked like they could be getting better. You know, we were electing openly queer people. We were passing anti-discrimination ordinances. And yes, there was resistance, and pretty heavy resistance, but there were good reasons in 1978 to believe that the next decade would be a lot better than the previous decade.
Today on Castro Street, people have a wide range of feelings about the rainbow flag.
It's gone real commercial.
Seeing the rainbow flag for the first time was a jaw-dropping experience.
I don't really think I have a ton to, I don't have a lot of strong opinions about the rainbow flag.
The flag as a symbol has also changed with the times. Subsets of the LGBTQ community have made their own flags, including the pink, blue, and white trans flag and the bear flag in earth tones. Some people criticize the symbol, saying it's been co-opted by capitalist interests. But at some point, Andrew Schaffer of the GLBT Historical Society Museum says he began to understand that for many people, the symbol of the rainbow flag means I will be safe in this space.
And so to be charged with not taking care of like the object that made all of that possible is a pretty awesome responsibility. And it's also, I think, a delight to be able to share that with so many people.
Cleve Jones has said this symbol couldn't have been created anywhere else.
It was something special and unique and wonderful about San Francisco, our history, our geography, our architecture, the air, the way the fog comes down the hills. This is a wonderful place.
That story first aired in November and was reported by Audio Academy alum Sandra Holliday and Alistair Boone and produced by Lisa Morehouse. We have more stories about the oldest parts of San Francisco at kalw.org/crosscurrents. Today's team includes Michaela Sia, Christopher Alam, Hussein Khan, James Rollins, Ganadi Joe Johnson, Victor Tense, Shireen Adel, Angela Johnston, and Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet, as interpreted by Daoud Anthony. For Cross Currents, I'm Marissa Ortega-Welch.